Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, June 2nd, 2017. Unprofessional vaccination operation leads to the death of more than a dozen children in Kapoita State.
A single reconstitution syringe was used for multiple vaccines, while for the entire 4 days of the campaign, in a state of being discarded after single use.
And a Sudan human rights group rolls out an online campaign to pressure the Trump administration on thinking twice before lifting sanctions on Sudan.
It's important that we alert the Trump administration about the ongoing crisis in Sudan and the threat that Sudan poses to the U.S. because of its role in promoting political Islam and supporting terrorist networks.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's health minister says 15 children died in Kapoita last month after a botched vaccination operation carried out by local health workers, according to the minister. He says the drug was administered to at least 300 children in former Eastern Equatoria State, as we hear from Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The tragic incident happened last month in a village called Nacho Dokopele in Kapoita State. Most of the children who died are said to be under the age of 5. An investigation backed by the World Health Organization carried out by a group called the National Adverse Events Following Immunization, or AEFI, revealed the children died from severe sepsis or toxicity caused by the contaminated vaccine. Minister Guy and the WHO country representative in South Sudan, Abdulmumin Asman, held a news conference today to describe the findings of an investigation. Guy told the reporters evidence gathered by investigators shows the vaccination team did not adhere to WHO-approved immunization safety standards, including using one syringe over and over.
A single reconstitution syringe was used for multiple vaccines, while for the entire 4 days of the campaign, in a state of being discarded after single use. The reuse of the reconstitution syringe causes it to become contaminated, which in turn contaminates the measles vaccine, vials, and infects the vaccinated children.
32 more children suffered similar symptoms of fever, vomiting, and diarrhea, but recovered. The investigators also found that the vaccination team did not follow the cold chain protocols of the measles supplementary activities guidelines. Investigators found the vaccines were stored in a building with no cold chain facilities for 4 days, meaning the vaccines were contaminated because they did not remain cold for several days. Guy also said that 12-year-old and 13-year-old children may have been recruited to help with the vaccination campaign.
The Minister of Health has commissioned a multi-agency administrative committee to review the AEFI report and give appropriate recommendations for further actions to improve immunization service delivery.
Abdulmumin Asman says the campaign was meant to prevent an outbreak of measles in the country, but so far this year at least 70 children have died from measles across South Sudan.
This lesson that we have learned that should not also be a source of preventing the continuation of vaccination. Vaccines are safe if they follow the guidelines.
Guy and Asman say the risk of contracting measles and other diseases in South Sudan remains extremely high because of challenges in the current healthcare system. They say the country has experienced a significant measles outbreaks among unprotected populations due to a backlog of unvaccinated children in areas affected by rampant insecurity. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The Troika countries, made up of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Norway, are calling on the Sudanese government and the Darfur-based Sudan Liberation Movement, Mini Arkominawi faction, to end hostilities and immediately reach a ceasefire agreement. A Troika statement says the renewed fighting erupted in northern Darfur late last month when rebel leader Mini Arkominawi received reinforcements from outside Darfur. The government accuses Egypt of providing reinforcement to the rebels. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir said last month his forces captured dozens of Egyptian-made military vehicles that the Darfuri rebels used to attack Sudan from Libya and South Sudan. Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal echoed the same accusations, adding that Egypt is trying to disrupt the relative peace Darfur has enjoyed since President Bashir declared a ceasefire early this year following the partial lifting of U.S. sanctions on Sudan. Bilal says the rebels are trying to convince U.S. officials to reconsider the sanctions.
We think this is the exact purpose of the attack, and it is being funded and sponsored by Egypt. The main goal for that is to say that we linked by the civilians, to say that Darfur is still now is not stable, so we need an extension for the sanctions. That is what they want to say.
Sudanese-Egyptian relations have deteriorated recently over a number of issues, including the disputed border areas of Halaib and Shalatin, which both countries claim. Egypt has military control over the two areas. Egypt and Sudan both deny they have connection with the recent attacks in North Darfur. Bilal says Sudanese troops did not violate the ceasefire in Darfur, saying they were defending themselves against rebel attacks.
We didn't actually attack them where they are there. They are coming to us. They are attacking our peaceful areas. It is not an attack from Sudan. We are in a self-defense situation.
Sudanese political commentator Ismail Ibrahim says achieving peace in Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states is very important for normalizing relations between Khartoum and Washington. He says violations of the ceasefire in Darfur can indeed threaten the possibility of a complete lifting of U.S. sanctions on Sudan.
If that happens, of course, it is going to be a very serious setback, you know, after the country has made some major steps on the process of bringing about peace and particularly broadening the scope of the national dialogue that has got to involve new forces, the rebels who have not yet come to sign an agreement between them and the government on one side and also other major opposition parties.
But Ibrahim says Khartoum is aware of what is at stake. He says it is possible the rebels in Darfur pushed government troops into the recent fighting.
I don't think that the government at this moment, given the internal and the regional and the international development, has any benefit to get in any kind of military engagement, you know, with the rebels or any other parts. Yeah, I tend to believe, you know, the government position that is acting on self-defense.
Several calls, South Sudan in focus, made to the Sudanese rebel leader Mini Minnawi went unanswered. Ibrahim says the government's top priority should be protection of civilians in Darfur. He says officials should also reach out to the rebels to find a peaceful solution to the conflict. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
social media users will get a chance to take part in a 30-day internet campaign designed to pressure U.S. President Donald Trump to establishing what activists are calling a smart policy on Sudan. The campaign by Sudan Unlimited, a U.S.-based group that lobbies for human rights in Sudan and South Sudan, began tweeting yesterday, asking top U.S. officials to analyze whether or not the government of Sudan has sustained positive actions that would warrant complete lifting of sanctions permanently. President Donald Trump has until July 12 to decide if U.S. sanctions against Sudan should be reviewed. Sudan Unlimited founder Esther Prague tells Ayen Bure human rights violations continue across Sudan.
We're hoping to advise the president and other government officials regarding smart U.S. policy on Sudan and, you know, appropriate U.S. policy on Sudan for a regime that's indicted by the International Criminal Court for genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes that are ongoing.
What do you want the outcome of this campaign to be?
We're sending the tweets to the president and to people in the government who are responsible for advising Secretary Tillerson on whether or not to continue U.S. sanctions on Sudan. We're also including chairs of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee, just with the hope that they'll be able to influence the administration with regard to smart policy. What we're hoping ultimately is that the people of Sudan will have the opportunity to recover their country and have the opportunity to lead peaceful, you know, and prosperous lives. You know, for this campaign, we hope to help the administration understand why it is important to take Sudan seriously because of its links to terrorism and because of the danger, you know, of fragile states pose to U.S. and international security. And we believe, based on the actions of the Bashir regime, that President Obama was misguided in his decision to lift sanctions. We're urging the Trump administration to use sanctions and other measures strategically to stabilize the country in a way that would end conflict and provide support to people who have suffered for far too long under the Bashir regime.
Are you arguing that the decision to ease sanctions was not smart Sudan policy?
The executive order was based on certain actions that were perceived to be positive. And those actions were maintaining a cessation of hostilities, allowing humanitarian access, you know, cooperation with the U.S. on regional conflicts, cooperation with U.S. on terrorism. Those things aren't happening. You know, currently there are attacks on civilians in Darfur. You know, besides bombing and the use of chemical weapons in Jebel Marra, we're told that 90 villages in central Darfur were recently attacked. The Janjaweed have cut off passageways so that people can reach IDP camps. The regime is flying its jets over South Kordofan and the Nuban Mountains intentionally just to traumatize civilians who've already survived thousands of bombings by the regime. You know, basic freedoms don't exist. Civil society spaces are closed. The U.S. needs to use the financial tools at its disposal to confront what the Enough Project calls the violent kleptocratic system constructed by Bashir and his inner circle. We need to do this in order to promote lasting peace and disrupt and ultimately dismantle the most enduring root cause of continuing conflict and dictatorship in Sudan.
That was Esther Prague, founder of Sudan Unlimited, speaking to Ayen Bure from the West Coast state of California. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at what local NGOs are doing in Imatong State. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you want to get up in the morning?
There's a plan to achieve something, so when I get up in the morning, there's a drive.
to achieve something at the end of the day. That's what makes me get up and move.
Just to be able to grow in my profession and to provide for my children. Yeah, because I'm a mother, so I want to be able to give my children the needs of life.
Now for me, I have a dream of being a pilot. Yes, but I'm still young. I need to pray hard that every morning I have to wake up in order to achieve my dream and my goals. So that's what makes me wake up in the morning.
Plans to be achieved, those are the things that get me up. To be a blessing to somebody and do what I believe God wants me to do.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Local non-governmental organizations in Imatong State are protesting against the increase in registration fees introduced by the government. NGOs used to pay $150 for registration, but now NGOs have to pay more than that for them to receive operation license. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Torit.
After meeting in Torit today, officials from more than 20 NGOs petitioned the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission to cut the fee in half from $500 to $250. Most community-based organizations say the increased registration fees will force many of them to close. Charles Okulu, chairperson of the Imatong Estate Civil Society Network, submitted the group's written petition to South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Torit. Okulu says most local NGOs simply cannot afford the new charges.
The decree comes at a time when the economic situation is tough on every sector of society, a time when civil society organizations can hardly afford the running of their day-to-day office to support the citizens of South Sudan. Given such situation, the decree would make civil society organizations to risk being shut down.
Okulu says such fees are not practical.
For this reason, we do hereby urge your highly esteemed office to 1. Reconsider the decree for the increment of the registration fee for NGOs, CSOs, and faith-based, and reduce the prescribed fees for registration to $250 or its equivalent in South Sudanese pounds.
Oriama Emmanuel is the Imatong State Coordinator for the civil society group South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections. Emmanuel says the new fees will also curtail service delivery.
Most of them are non-profit making organizations. They only support poor, the community which are not able to support themselves. Sometimes they support them in terms of service delivery when they get the donations from some other donors. And the civil society does not have what they call the capital.
John Odongi is the Eastern Equatorial State Director for the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission. He says the decision to increase registration fees is irreversible.
The decision has been taken from above that there would be an increase of registration fee to all the national organizations, international and the civil societies organizations operating in the country.
Odongi says he has realized the higher fees are a hardship for most groups, but says there is nothing his commission can do about it.
Definitely, some may be affected and the rest will not be affected because we know very well that these civil societies are getting money. They have donors who are giving them the money. And if you compare even the rate of that registration, $500, compared with the salaries of each and every staff in an organization, how much is he getting per month?
The higher registration fees went into effect in early May. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
Hundreds of South Sudanese fleeing violence are stranded by the Kiju River along the South Sudan-Uganda border. The swollen river, caused by heavy rains, is making it impossible for families to cross into Uganda where they are seeking asylum. Mungume Devs Rokarinj has more for VOA from Arua.
About 100 people, mainly women and children, sit under a tree that provides a little shade at the Busia entry point on the Uganda side of the South Sudan-Uganda border. Despite the swollen waters, the refugees took their chances and crossed the Kiju River and are in Uganda's border district of Koboko, waiting for authorities to transport them for a refugee camp. The exhausted-looking refugees say they are hungry and tired. Some older South Sudanese who made the journey can barely walk. 74-year-old Judita Moliba says she has spent more than a week camped out along the river's edge because she cannot swim. Speaking in her native Kakwa language, Moliba says she eventually was given 2,000 Ugandan shillings from a well-wisher, which she used to pay someone to carry her across the river.
The river was so full that I could not manage to cross by myself. Each day I would keep seeking help for someone to help carry me to cross, but they keep demanding for money, which I could not have. Yet I did not have my relative to help carry me for free.
27-year-old Neema Gaba says she fled Payawa Boma about 10 kilometers from Yei Town with her three children to escape hunger. Gaba says in her Kakwa language, she sold some personal belongings to raise the money needed to get her family across the river.
My three children could not manage to cross by themselves. Because the river was very full, I had to pay some men to help them cross the river.
Gaba says even though she had food in the garden, she was afraid to venture out due to the rampant insecurity. She says her children would often go to bed on an empty stomach and cry themselves to sleep. Speaking in Arabic, Jackson Batali of Mugo Payam says his family fled South Sudan because of insecurity. He says they had to wait for days to cross the river.
When we arrived at Chidjo River, it was very full. I had to wait for 4 days at the bank of the river with my family until water subsided.
But Ale says he witnessed some of his relatives being brutally murdered by men in uniform. Joseph Ochanda works in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister, which is in charge of refugee affairs. Speaking to the new arrivals through a translator, Ochanda welcomed the South Sudanese to Uganda.
South Sudan and Uganda, these are sister countries. The problem you are going through there has equally affected us.
South Sudan ko Uganda karanga a jirani.
When we see children with women moving like this, we don't feel happy. We feel so sad, but we shall try our best to help you.
Ochanda says most of the new arrivals arrive tired and hungry because they have spent days walking and hiding in the bush. More than 800,000 South Sudanese have fled to Uganda since the conflict broke out in Juba in December 2013 and has since spread across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj reporting from Arua District, Uganda.
And now for some good news. A music producer from Yambio says all his equipment was stolen during conflict in the former Western Equatoria state. Emmanuel Yore, who is also known as MEJ, has opened a new production studio in Kampala. He says his Uganda-based Revolution Records Africa studio has yielded more benefits. Gift Friday has the story for VOA from Arua.
MJ, a father of five, spends most of his days at his studio in Kampala's Machinde neighborhood, producing music for upcoming Ugandan singers and other artists from neighboring countries. He says he and his family fled the fighting in Yambio in 2015 after his studio was looted.
During the war, we lost everything we had. We lost the machines. We lost the place we had. I remember I ran to Congo. Then from there, I started doing the same work with some studios around there. Then I came to Uganda, and I decided to invest the little resources I was getting in the production back into setting up the same Revolution. Now we have it in Uganda.
Emi says his 13 years of producing music have not been easy, but he kept his head down and pushed on.
We were a blessing in South Sudan. Now the war has scattered us all over the world. I would also use this opportunity to be a blessing in Uganda. If I walk out of this place one day and I'm remembered, then that pays my effort. It rewards me.
Emi says he has produced more than 10 albums for Ugandan and Congolese musicians since opening his studio 3 months ago. Emi says he charges between 200,000 and 500,000 Ugandan shillings, or between 60 and 130 US dollars to record a song, depending on whether it is a live production or instrumental. And he says it is gratifying to see that he's making a profit after opening his Ugandan studio just a few months ago than he ever earned from his studio in South Sudan.
The kind of production we do is very diverse. We combine African traditional element of the music. We also modernize the African traditional music. We research deep in the African instruments used. And then we identify the melodic structure, the beat patterns. We've been doing that in Uganda, in South Sudan, in Congo, exploring the indigenous African cultures to bring up something rare.
Emi says he loves music but quit singing several years ago when the fighting broke out in South Sudan.
South Sudan became so sensitive that everything you say, good or bad, must be scrutinized. So that's why I released a song in my native language, Mubandangbaroch Pachipo, which basically means keep your mouth for food. So after I released that song, I went low profile, which means I don't have to talk about anything in South Sudan now.
Emi says he will only open a branch of his production studio in South Sudan when the country is peaceful and stable.
Because development requires security. When we feel we are safe and our properties are safe, we are going back. Home is home. We'll open another one. There will be serving in both.
But he says he's optimistic that South Sudan will change and change for the better.
It is only the strong heart that can forgive. And the South Sudanese are known all over the world for being strong. So as a strong people, I ask us to forgive. And I'm praying for a day South Sudan will be one nation, one people, as we have always said. And we will be looking beyond tribal, ethnic, political boundaries. So it starts with me, it starts with you.
For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Arua, northern Uganda.
That's our show for this Friday, and we are going to leave you with more music from Emi J. Yore. This one is called Yangada Gajia.
Mini natani gyapa, mini natani gyapa, Emi. Mini na vumuririza.
Kuru ya pasa konda koro. Kamu pingo kumba korote, ah, kamfura ye biko, unikata na kina wapa inga mina waka wakareme, muyebile mini meleko jere yo, ini kiti wala gafare. Nye fora kacha mamama, mina suga edo nunga kacha lala.
We have been listening to Emi J. Yore with the song Yangada Gadia. At least something nice coming from South Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We hope you have a safe and peaceful weekend. We'll see you back here next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.